My guest is Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. She served as the ninth president of Spelman College in Atlanta from 2002 to 2015. She received the Carnegie Academic Leadership Award during her tenure, and in 2014, she received an award for lifetime contribution to psychology, the highest award presented by the American Psychological Association. Dr. Tatum is the author of four books, including the New York Times bestseller, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? Her latest book is titled Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. Welcome to The Exchange, Dr. Tatum.
Thank you so much, Mike. I'm happy to be with you.
Well, my first question is a doozy because your book is timely. And when I survey the societal landscape, I see the first Black woman president of Harvard resign under attack. I see the first Black woman attorney general in New York under attack. I see the first Black woman on the board of the Federal Reserve under attack. I see cities headed by Black women mayors, like Los Angeles and D.C., under attack. I see widespread coordinated assaults on the landscape of DEI. I see schools, libraries, and museums under attack. And I see reports that more than 300,000 Black women have lost their jobs in just the last 6 months. These are indeed turbulent times, particularly for Black women.
You're so right. I'm sorry to interrupt. Without question, it's just really challenging, no doubt about that.
How would you describe the conditions in America today for leaders of institutions of higher education?
Well, regardless of whether you are a Black woman or a white man or anyone else, it's a challenging time in higher education for lots of reasons. Some of those challenges precede the current administration. The changing birth rate, the decline in the birth rate, means college enrollments are declining in a lot of places because there are not as many students as there once were to fill the seats. The rising cost of education, whether that's because of the need to spend money on advancing technology or just give your faculty and staff raises, all of that is a challenge for a president to balance a budget and to remain affordable and accessible. When we think about guns and gun violence and the impact of school shootings on college campuses, the sense of safety, the residue, I'm going to call it, of the pandemic in terms of what we refer to as the loneliness epidemic and people's sense of social isolation. All those things were happening before Donald Trump was inaugurated. But certainly since his inauguration, those challenges have been magnified by the executive orders declaring DEI initiatives illegal. That is, of course, a question for lawyers to dispute. But nonetheless, people are feeling pressure to move away from DEI. The changes in how we think about gender, only to don't include, don't acknowledge the experiences of transgender students on your campus, for example. There are lots of things that are happening that, not to mention perhaps the most troubling, the cutback in all the research grants that had been funded, leaving scholars scrambling to figure out how to complete research studies that have been underway for years, and institutions trying to figure out how to offset the loss in revenue that they need to balance their budgets. I could go on, but as you see, there are many challenges for all of us, regardless of how we identify. But I think the attack on DEI is particularly painful for leaders of color, because often they are being tarred with a brush that says, you know, maybe you weren't really qualified for your job. That's certainly the rhetoric we heard when Claudine Gay was under attack at Harvard.
Well, with the exacerbation of adverse conditions on campus, why would anyone today want to step into the role of college leadership?
It's a great question, and it's one of the reasons I wrote my book, to be honest, because the year that I was spending as interim president at Mount Holyoke, that was academic year 2022-2023, many of my friends said, why would you do that? It's so hard now. You know, you were president at Spelman for 13 years, but then you retired from that. Why would you take it up again? And it was a good question, but it also overlooked the power and excitement about being part of the educational enterprise, seeing lives transformed and being able to contribute to that in a leadership role for younger people. I am out of the business, I will say that. No new presidents for me. But when you think about the opportunity to meet wonderful people, work with fabulous students, talented faculty, to be engaged in problem solving, the kind that can really make a difference, not just on your campus, but in the world, and to advance the mission, the purpose of the institution. All of that can combine to be tremendously gratifying despite the challenges. And I think there are a lot of talented people who would indeed do a wonderful job at taking on some of those challenges if they were willing. So part of the book was to persuade those people. But I also know that's a small audience. There are lots of people who I think will get a better understanding of colleges and how they work. And that was part of my intention too, to really convey, to pull the curtain back on some of what seems mysterious about how colleges and universities operate the way they do.
Well, it sounds like you want people to be part of the solution. Princeton professor Eddie Glau Jr. wrote this about your book, quote, "With American higher education under assault, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum has written a timely and critically important book, Peril and Promise, details the challenges facing American colleges and universities, and, with clarity and wisdom, she offers a brilliant roadmap to secure the future of America's crown jewel, a must-read for current leaders of colleges and universities and for those who aspire to lead," end quote. Dr. Tatum, are the conditions of assault upon the institutions of higher education today distinctly different from the conditions of three generations ago in the 1960s, or reminiscent of those conditions?
I think they're distinctly different, and I'll tell you why. Though, of course, there are some things that are reminiscent. So, for example, there's a chapter in the book that talks about student protests. Student protests are not new. Certainly, I came of age at a time when the protests surrounding the Vietnam War and activism related to the civil rights movement was part of the student experience. We can think of the protests that students engaged in the 80s, when the topic of the day was apartheid in South Africa. There's a long history going back to time immemorial, perhaps, of students protesting on college campuses. So that part may seem familiar. But what is uniquely different, I think, at this particular moment is the way in which the federal government is really blowing apart what has been a decades-long partnership with colleges and universities, particularly around the advancement of science, for example. After World War II, it became critical to the United States to invest in higher education rather than the government building its own research labs and hiring all its own research scientists. It took advantage of the fact that colleges and universities had those facilities, had those scholars, and partnered by giving grants and providing financial support to those institutions to advance all the science we now take advantage of, whether that's the computer science or medical breakthroughs or you name it, all the different ways our society has changed for the better since the mid-20th century, the 1940s and later. And now we have the government saying, we don't like what you're teaching, we're taking your money away. We don't like who you're admitting, we're going to threaten your accreditation. We don't like how you are allowing free speech on your campus, we're going to punish you for that. That kind of punitive withholding of resources is something that I've not seen in my lifetime. And most educators, I think, would say is new and potentially quite destructive.
My guest is Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. Dr. Tatum, you referred to an executive order issued by Donald Trump titled Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. What was the impact of that executive order?
It's had a tremendous impact because, as it has been further explained, you know, when the government issues a policy, they do something called sending a Dear Colleague letter. The Department of Education does this from time to time, where they send a letter and it's addressed in that way, Dear Colleague, here's what this executive order means, here's what you need to do. And that Dear Colleague letter that went out in February following that executive order said, you know, you need to cease and desist doing anything that seems at all race-based. Of course, we already knew that race-based admissions had been outlawed by the Supreme Court decision involving affirmative action. That was not new. But they said things like, you can't have special graduation ceremonies. That's a common thing for Black students or first-gen students or other special groups to want to celebrate their success with a ceremony that coincides with, doesn't replace, the large campus gathering but a special ceremony to acknowledge their achievement. Very common and much valued by the students who participate. The government said, nope, can't do that. Can't have affinity housing. Can't do anything that would somehow separate or reinforce an understanding of that group as in need of something special, no special treatment. And many colleges and universities have had that reinforced, not just by the executive order, but particularly in Republican-led states by state legislators that have kind of piled on with similar requirements. You know, you can't teach about this. Don't use that language. I live in the state of Georgia, and in Georgia, a law passed that said no teaching of, quote, divisive concepts. We could talk about what a divisive concept is, but generally speaking, the emphasis seems to be limiting conversation about topics related to race and racism or other isms in our society, particularly at the K through 12 level, but also in some instances in higher education. Florida, for example, has taken sociology off the list of common core teaching. You can't take a sociology course now to satisfy a graduation requirement, only history, for example. Those kinds of changes, the kind of, I'm going to call it micromanaging of colleges and universities, has been happening at the state level, but also at the federal level. And it has caused institutions to close down the offices of diversity, equity, and inclusion, maybe renaming that to something else, but basically moving away from activities that were particularly designed to create a warm and welcoming environment for those who have been historically marginalized. In this case, typically students of color or LGBTQ students or other students who have been on the margins of the educational experience for one reason or another.
I find it ironic that this same president issued an executive order establishing a committee to celebrate the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. And this nation was founded upon the idea of racial hierarchy, the valuing and devaluing of humans by this mythological construct of race and white supremacy.
Yes.
And it started as a whites-only national citizenry. And then after the Civil War, you had all of these race laws, racialized laws. As you know, the Supreme Court in 1896 doubled down on the fact that this was two separate societies, one white, wealthy, and powerful, the other poor, black, and powerless. It was a racialized, segregationist society built on laws, systems, public policies, and private sector practices all around race. And now we're saying we want to celebrate the national founding of this nation as a whites-only national citizenry. That's about race, while we're saying you can't talk about race.
Yes, there's so many contradictions. There's so many contradictions. You know, the whole notion of taking away the birthright citizenship, for example.
14th Amendment.
Yes, about race, right? It was that birthright citizenship that allowed enslaved people to become citizens after the end of the Civil War. The question, there's so many contradictions. And I want to talk about the one about eliminating race and being a meritocratic society. The administration, the Trump administration, seems to really be doubling down on, particularly at the elite institutions, the most elite, the most selective, Harvard, Princeton, Columbia, Brown, you know, these highly selective institutions admit maybe 5% or less of the students who apply. So it's very, very selective. And many people thought after the Supreme Court ruling outlawing race considerations in admission that the numbers of Black and Brown students would drop dramatically. And at some places, there was a decline, but it was not dramatic, not nearly as dramatic as had been predicted. And in some places, I think Princeton was a place where it didn't drop at all, or very little. And now the government is saying, we want to see your data. Because people said, well, if the numbers didn't change much, they must be cheating. They must still be using race-based admissions, or they're using proxies for race, like where somebody lives, or you know, their zip code or something. They must be doing something that is trying to work around that prohibition.
Is there a
And so now the federal government is saying, We want to see all of your data, and we want you to completely disaggregate. We want to know like what somebody's GPA was, what their SAT scores were, and all of that broken down by race, so we can see if you are in fact following the law.
Let's hold it right there.
But of course.
Let's hold it right there. That's a good cliffhanger because we do have to take a short break.
Sure.
I'll be right back with my guest, Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum. Before the break, we were talking about the irony of racial quotas or demands or the elimination of race. And yet, at the same time, the government is asking for the data from colleges based on race. Please continue, yeah, Dr. Tatum.
Yes. So that requirement, on the one hand, saying don't pay attention to race, don't talk about race, and now give me all your racial data, is very contradictory. But what also is interesting and very little discussed on the part of this administration is the way in which other characteristics, particularly at these very elite institutions, influence who is admitted in ways that would seem to have very little to do with merit. For example, a 2023 study done by Opportunity Insights, which is a group of economists based at Harvard, found that attending an Ivy Plus college is a very fast track ticket to, you know, economic success post-graduation. One of the reasons so many people want to go, because it really increases the likelihood that you'll get into a top graduate school or be offered a prestigious employment opportunity. But what they found was that students who are athletes or legacies, meaning children of someone who attended previously, or coming from a family that can make a big gift, which puts them on a special donor list that the deans control, or child of an employee, a faculty member or staff member, that those groups, the athletes, the legacies, the dean's list people, and the children, known collectively as ALDC, that acronym, that those students are much more likely to be admitted than any other group of students. And most of them are white and from higher income households because of the way our society is structured. Even the athletes are more likely to come from white affluent families because it costs money to participate in sports and to be able to go to summer sports camps and all the things that put you, that develop your talent. So the point I'm making here is simply that the administration is not talking about the fact that the largest beneficiaries of preferential treatment in admissions are wealthy and well-connected white students. They're wanting to know all about that much smaller percentage of Black and Brown students and what their grades and SAT scores were.
So it sounds like there must be some sort of pretextual assumption that these people of color, these students of color, do not merit, do not rise to the standard of admission into these universities.
I think that is exactly the implication of their investigation or their expressed interest in investigating.
Well, your book is about a roadmap for college leaders to use in these turbulent times. And what I'd like for you to do, if you would, please, is to read an excerpt from your book.
I'd be happy to do that. So I'm going to start near the beginning to just set the context, perhaps, for some of what we've been talking about. I was heading back to Mount Holyoke College to serve as the interim president for the 2022-2023 academic year. I spent 13 years at Mount Holyoke earlier in my career, from 1989 to 2002, first as a professor of psychology, then as a dean, and for 6 months as acting president, before I left in July 2002 to become the president of Spelman College. In March 2022, the chair of the Mount Holyoke Board of Trustees contacted me to discuss the presidential transition underway at the college. President Sonia Stevens had just announced her intention to accept a new position as president of the American University of Paris. She would be stepping down as president of Mount Holyoke College at the end of June. The chair asked if I would be willing to serve as interim president for the coming 2022-2023 school year while the search for the next permanent president was underway. I was intrigued by the possibility. Soon to be 68, I was not interested in the job on a long-term basis, but the idea of returning to Mount Holyoke for just 1 year was appealing to me. Finding the right person to serve as college president is a daunting and time-consuming task. I knew that having an experienced president in the role as interim would make the process easier for everyone. The college had given me so many career-transforming opportunities at a pivotal time in my life. It seemed only right that during its time of need, I should return and give something back to the institution that had given so much to me. On July 1, 2022, I returned to the campus of Mount Holyoke as the interim president, exactly 20 years from the day I had left it to head to Atlanta. It felt like a homecoming, a full circle moment. To paraphrase the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, you can never step in the same river twice. The college had grown and changed during those 20 years, as had I, and the world was rapidly changing around us. For example, just a week before, on June 24, 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court had delivered its ruling in the Dobbs v. Jackson women's health case, overturning the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, in a major setback for reproductive rights. My return to the campus as interim president coincided with this and other global inflection points that impacted everyone. We had all come through 2 long years of a global pandemic. We could see the escalation of global conflict as wars raged in Ukraine and elsewhere. We recognized the backlash against racial progress and the rise of white nationalist movements at home and abroad. We witnessed the pushback against LGBTQ plus rights and the increase of transphobic legislation. We could see evidence of the impact of climate change locally and globally. The mental health crisis and the growing threat of gun violence challenged our collective sense of safety. Budgetary pressures and resulting increases in tuition were continuing to fuel the crisis of college affordability. The public questioning of the value of higher education was troubling, and the pool of college-going students was predicted to shrink. In short, the world as we had known it seemed to be unraveling. Yet, it is in just such a time as this that colleges and universities, institutions that encourage us to think critically about important social issues and exercise our capacity for leadership, become beacons of hope and sources of inspiration. Colleges and universities are communities of problem solvers, communities that attract creative thinkers. They are places where leaders can see the impact of the work they do every day, where effective leadership can be transformational. Despite the challenges, a college campus is a wonderful place to be. It was energizing to be back on the campus in a leadership role. 12 months later, together with the Mount Holyoke community, we had navigated the end of COVID protocols and managed a COVID-related campus building takeover, galvanized trustee support for the transition from gas-powered heating and cooling to a carbon-neutral geothermal heat exchange system, gained approval of a new, more concise, an impactful mission statement as part of the strategic planning process, and most importantly, helped to rebuild the spirit of community and campus optimism about the college's future. The campus was ready to welcome its new leader.
My guest is Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, author of Peril and Promise, College Leadership in Turbulent Times. Dr. Tatum, you led one of the nation's premier HBCUs. What's the relevance today of historically Black colleges and universities?
Well, you know, one of the things, it was a tremendous privilege, let me just say that, a tremendous privilege to serve for 13 years as the president of Spelman College. And I was every day impressed by the talented young women who passed through those gates. And today, I watch what those graduates are doing and how they're changing the world. And it's just a source of inspiration always. The fact that students can go to an institution like Spelman or Morehouse or Howard, my parents were both Howard graduates, so I'll call myself a Howard baby. The fact of the matter is, our HBCUs provide space for young people to come and be able to say, these halls, this place was built for me. It's a place where I can be myself, not be seen always through the lens of race. You know, nobody's walking around thinking about me because I am different from other people. They're seeing me as an individual, not a representative of a group of Black women or Black men. And so I know how empowering that is for students. And one of the things that has been happening, in part because of the polarizing anti-Black rhetoric that has been so much a part of the environment we are all living in the last several years, is that applications for HBCUs have just gone through the roof. I know that's been true at Spelman. I know it's true at Morehouse, at Howard, at other places, Hampton, probably FAMU, you name the HBCUs that you know the best. But the fact of the matter is many young people who are on their way to college are choosing to go to HBCUs because they find a welcoming environment and the outcomes of HBCUs are so impressive. We know that HBCUs, and I write about this in the book, have been chronically underfunded. But despite that, the graduates of those HBCUs are more likely to enter the middle class if they've come from low-income families. They're more likely to have academic and economic success if they attended an HBCU than if they attended a PWI.
And that's students of all races, right?
Well, mostly, I would say students of all races in the sense that HBCUs are not exclusively Black. That said, the research I just was citing about the outcomes were for Black students in particular. We do know that some HBCUs, particularly the state HBCUs, have more white students than they did previously. But it is, in most cases, I'll use Spelman as an example, while there's an occasional white student who enrolls at Spelman, almost all of the students are African American. It's certainly open to anyone to apply, but students operate with their own self-selection in place, and it's the unusual white student who chooses to put themselves in the racial minority.
So Dr. Tatum, allow me to set the stage for my next question.
Sure.
Funding for research is being cut. Student funding is under attack. International students face serious threats. The financial options for lower-income students who want to go to college are being diminished. And the messaging that's on the rise is that college isn't worth the expense or the time, and the return on investment isn't worth the risk, which is high, given the low percentages of students who graduate on time. These are real conditions facing college presidents, Dr. Tatum. So what do leaders need to do to sustain themselves in the face of so much pressure to navigate these turbulent waters?
Well, I think that it's important to say, relative to the statistics you just cited, in terms of is college worth it, the cost of college, the debt you might take on, the risk of not graduating. All those things are important questions that parents and their students need to be paying attention to. But there are institutions with good leadership that have really made an impact. I live in Atlanta, Georgia, and I want to lift up, for example, Georgia State University. Georgia State University is also located in Atlanta. It's a large public institution in the heart of the city. And under the leadership of its previous president, Dr. Mark Becker, they really leaned into trying to understand what was it that kept students from graduating? What were the impediments? Sometimes those were financial. Sometimes it was the result of not getting the right advice at the right time. For example, signing up for courses that wouldn't necessarily get you to the finish line because they weren't part of the required courses you needed to take. All of these things they looked at and tried to solve for. And over time, with a very intentional student-centered focus, they were able to deliver great results, where today Black students and low-income students come to Georgia State and graduate at the same rates as all other students do.
That is amazing. Unfortunately, we have about a minute left, and I have one other question I want to squeeze in just before we close. You offer a roadmap at a time of great national need and urgency. What do you want your readers to take away from this book?
I want readers to, one, understand how colleges and universities work, two, why they are so important to all of us, and three, what they can do as readers to support their local presidents, to speak up about the value of higher education, and hopefully appreciate the transformational nature and the way that education is still a part, a critical part, of a thriving democracy.
Oh, well spoken. Bottom line, though, if institutions like Harvard and Yale can't withstand the gale force winds of political assaults that we're seeing, what does that mean for thousands of others?
It means to me that the thousands of college graduates that are living and working in the United States today need to speak up on behalf of not only their own alma maters, but the higher education industry to say, enough already. This is the crown jewel of the United States, our leadership in higher education. We don't want to destroy it.
Well stated. That's all the time we have. Thank you so much for writing this book, Dr. Tatum.
Thank you so much for having me.